So we're going to turn this back over to Chuck. So
is our guy ready? Is he ready?
Mike, are you ready?
Mike,
you good?
Good.
Oh, great. I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, guys. I want to thank you guys that have actually shared a little bit of red, and I want to encourage anybody here to please get involved in that, because this is not any kind of a class or anything. It's more of a discussion, so the more input we get, the better. And if there's something that we're covering that sounds ridiculously stupid or doesn't make sense, please raise your hand and go, you know what, I don't get that. And let's try to talk about it a little bit. I promise you will not be ridiculed. I promise you there is no wrong question. And you might get some wrong answers, but we'll try to do what we can here. Because I want to encourage that, because it makes it a lot fun. I can't sit and talk for hours on end. I need some help and to see what we're doing and move on through some things here. I want to go back to the book, and let's look at the example on page 35 of Jim. Because we're going to talk about this. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who time after time repeats a desperate experimentation of the first drink? Why does he does this? This is the baffling feature of alcoholism, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. This idea over and over and over. And we cannot do the process justice in the time we have. So I would encourage you to grab a sponsor, somebody else, and actually read this book. What I've been doing for a number of years is when I get a guy that I'm working with, is we read page by page. Regardless of how much time they have sobriety, they may have time when we start working together, they may not. But we read page by page, and when it says to do something, we do it. And we do it together, and I have learned, I'm continually learning from that over and over and over. Even sometimes the guy's got, you know, he's a new guy with 40 days, and I'm learning, like, whoa, he sees it a little differently. So it's an exciting process to go over and over and over, and I hope it never gets stale. Let's go to let's read about Jim. Would somebody start off on our first example is Jim on page 35? And if you would please end at the bottom, don't go to the next page. Who wants to read?
I will.
Thank you.
Okay, our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and friends, and inherited a lucrative automobile agent. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent and intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us.
Let's stop for a second. Anybody here been to treatment? Ever been in treatment? When you see the word asylum, just put the treatment center that you were in there. Because that's what they're talking about. Because I'm like, yep, I've been to a couple of those. Continue on, please. I'm sorry.
We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. We made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work at facilities for the business to get lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, you lose his family for whom
you. Let's stop there. Anybody? Comments, questions?
Talking to God, and making God to be
He told me, go, don't pick that bottle up. Because I got to the point 15 months sober. You know, it was either pick up a gun or pick up a bottle. Those were my two choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, you know, God saw it fit for me to realize that I would destroy two wonderful children's lives if I did that. So I decided that's not the option for all the three.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like you said, though, man, before you take that first drink, the relief is there. I mean, I can sit there, I'm looking at that beer on the bar right now. Because that's the pain all over the way before I ever got that to my lips.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, for me, that's it. There's only one thing that can save me, and it's God. And, you know.
Thank you. This is the go to a treatment center a lot. This is me, and I see it over and over and over and over again. Because here's the deal. Okay, goes to a place, bad shape. Okay, I learn about alcoholism. I make a beginning. Here's the beginning. The beginning is I start going to meetings. I'm going to meetings. I'm not drinking. I'm going to work every day. Not drinking. Making some money. People like me again. I'm back in the big bed. Things are all right. But all went well for a time. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. How in the world would I do that?
Not go through the rest of the process. And then continue in steps 10, 11, and 12. He says, you know, they told him about alcohol in step 1.
Mm-hmm.
The answer they had found in step 2.
Mm-hmm.
He made a beginning in step 3. The book refers to step 3 as the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says he failed to finish the process.
Mm-hmm.
Right? On each of these occasions, they said they carefully reviewed with him what had happened.
Yep.
Did you see the physical craving? Did you see the mental craving? They're trying to get him. That's why if I could turn my business how many times somebody relapses. My job is to help him get a demonology of their condition. If I'm the one that's sitting with you and trying to help you, I got to know what am I helping you see?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Obviously, he wasn't clear on his condition to the point to where he needed to see that he needed to continue on in the spiritual path.
Yeah.
And what they were trying to do, they weren't sitting there coddling him. They were giving him a big dose of alcoholism and asking him if he was converted.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I think that's the crucial part there, is that, you know, sometimes going to any cases, and some people find, you know, that they may not agree with it, sometimes going to any place might be drinking again. And our book actually suggests that. If you're not convinced that you're one of us, step over to the nearest pharmacy and try some controlled drinks. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the goal is to get a full knowledge of your condition. I don't suggest that right away. However, if you're not convinced, me holding you into a meeting about Paul's Anonymous speaking that I'm going to convince you is not going to do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing better that's going to teach you than your own experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's just been my experience.
Mm-hmm. So this is the path he's starting to take. And then the question I come up with is, well, how do I enlarge my spiritual life? Obviously, the steps are designed to do that. But in Bill's story, he tells us exactly how to do it. If you go to page 14, let's go to page 14 real quickly. And on 14, the last paragraph on there, would someone like to read where it says, my friend had emphasized.
My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating the principles in all my affairs. Particularly, it was imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appalling and true for the alcoholic. But here it is. For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials of those spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead, indeed. With us,
it's
just like that.
Boom. It doesn't say get a meditation mat and pray for 2 hours, you know, on your, you know, it doesn't say that. It says work with others. It says take the process and pass it on. Work with others. Self-sacrifice. Work with others over and over and over. This is gets me out of the jackpot every time. I'm only here because of boatloads of new guys. I'm only here because of many, many cases in court and jail panels and whatever I've been asked to do that I didn't want to. I was divinely inconvenienced. Divinely inconvenienced when I really didn't want to go do that and had to, well, I've got to do it. And then go there and realize I want to do it. So we're there. He's not enlarging his spiritual life. He knows he's an alcoholic. He knows he can't drink. He knows it's all going away if he picks up a drink again. This guy knows it. And let's turn the page on page 36. Yet he got drunk again. There it is. And then if you read his story, we don't really have a lot of time here. He's got this blasé attitude. He's hanging out at the bar to have a sandwich and some milk. Really? And then another sandwich and some milk. I don't know who does that. And then he gets this idea, if I put a little bit of whiskey in here, it wouldn't hurt me on a full stomach. This is like, I love this guy. I love this guy. One more journey to the treatment center for Jim. Here was the idea. He was going to lose his job, his family, everything, to say nothing of how much he would suffer mentally and physically. And he pushed it all aside. And the idea that the milk wouldn't hurt him. And this is the insanity we're talking about. When you read the second step, when I used to read that, and they would, you know, I'd think, you know, I'm not insane. You guys are insane. I hear your stories. But I'm not insane. I'm not. And we're not talking about clinical psychology. We're not talking about what that the community there thinks about. I'm talking about the insane idea of the first drink. Clint Hodges, God rest his soul, used to grab guys and he would say to them, he'd say, tell me the craziest thing you ever did. And they would say, well, I burned the house down. I was drunk. I wrecked the car. He'd go, no, keep going. You're not telling me it. Well, let me think. And they would go on these horrible stories of insane things they did. And he'd say, you just told me a lot of stuff you did. And you left out the most insane thing you ever did. And they'd look at him baffled, and he would say, the most insane thing you ever did was, in light of what you know is going to happen, you picked up another drink. That is the insanity we're talking about. We're trying to address the insanity of the first drink and have a spiritual way of life. Why does it have to be spiritual? It's the only thing that's going to work. It's the only thing that's going to work. Because if you're like me, I'll come in here and tell you there's no power greater than myself. I don't believe in that. That's not me. But if I'm honest with myself, there's a power in my life. And it's running my game. It tells me what to do, when to do it.
Right. Another thing on that page you were talking about, where it talks about suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
The thought came on. You know, that's how quick that thought mm-hmm. came in your mind. That'll take you right out the door.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when people, you know, I used to be one of those people that would be armed with these mental defenses.
My last relapse was on the 12-step call. I was 7 months sober, doing going to 14 meetings a week at the minimum. I was on parole, I was on probation. Wow. I was in a relationship that was going to DUI classes. I had a job that I didn't want to leave. I was in a relationship that she told me if I drank again she'd stop. I had all these combinations of reasons why I shouldn't drink. Then I went to go help somebody today. Although I'd never been through the 12-step process, doing the 12-step call. and ended up drunk. And the guy that I was trying to 12-step ended up 12-stepping me. He's trying to talk me out. I'm sure you want to do this. You know? And that thought came suddenly. It thinks faster, it thinks smarter, and it knows me better than I know myself.
Mm-hmm.
And if I think I can keep up with alcoholism, that there's something that I can pop up into my mind that's going to deter me from taking the first drink, and I'm in the delusion that I'm an alcoholic, you know? And that's really what these pages, that these stories and these illustrations that you're giving us, is really highlighting, you know? And until I got in touch with that, then I really didn't understand my problem.
Yeah, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful for sure. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. The lack of a proportion of the ability to think straight in this area. Only in this area specifically is the dream. Maybe it's floating other parts of my life, but here the thought comes and I'm on a run. I remember being in a room with this guy one time, and I was new, and I said, Don, these obsessions are on me. I'm tasting it in my mouth, and I'm going crazy. And he said, kid, the obsession's not on you. And I'd say, no, you don't get it. I can't get it out of my head. He'd say, kid, the obsession's not on you. The obsession is a thought to the exclusion of all else. If you were obsessed, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You'd be in a bar right now. What you have are desires, thoughts, and old ideas coming in right now. If you want to sit around and think about it, you'll bring it back. Or if you want to take some action here, it'll go away. And it's hard in those spots. I have to remember that every one of those things, every desire or craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. If I'll do some stuff, I'll get to the end of that. and I'll come out a little stronger. It's just hard being in the middle when I don't know how to walk through it, when I'm getting my butt kicked by it and I can't see it. So we got this insanity, and it says it again, insanely trivial excuse, insane idea went out, insanely insufficient. It's littered throughout here. He peppers it. Then he tells us this crazy jaywalker story, which is, you know, I think every one of us at some point in the game where my life's fallen apart and I continue to do it over and over and over. I just can't stop doing it. And I'm not like other people. I'm not a problem drinker or a hard drinker or a moderate drinker. I'm the real alcoholic. We didn't really address that very much in the literature. It's a great piece to cover. The moderate drinker can stop, take it or leave it alone. Can anybody here take it or leave it alone? Okay, we eliminated those guys. They're not here. But I'm the Jekyll and Hyde guy. I'm the one that can't leave it alone. I always go back. I always go back. And on page number, I'd love to cover the rest. My favorite one is the last story. Fred, I love Fred's story, but we don't have time for that. But I do want to cover the summation of step one on page 43, at the bottom of 43. He kind of wraps up step one. He packages it for us really nicely. And this is what he says. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in fewer cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. I don't realize the higher power of my life has been the booze. It tells me what it's kind of like. It talks to me. It sounds like Barry White. Who loves you, baby? You know? Come here. And then it says, where's my money? Get in the car. I got to go see the kids. Where's my money? Get in the car. Mom's sick. Got to go see her. Where's my money? Get in the car. And I listen. Every time I listen to it, I have no defense against it. It has become the power. It is my higher power. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and booze is my higher power. I don't know about you. I wake up in the mornings when I'm actively drinking. I wake up in the mornings and I'm already plotting the day out. I'm already planning what's going to happen. Where am I going to get it? How am I going to... It's just... And I don't know about you. I'm the kind of alcoholic that I'm already paranoid before I ever... I'm not even... I just started and I'm already worried about running out. Right? I get panicky, you know. Because that's me. That's me. So I must substantiate the fact that I have a power run in my life. I'm going to need to switch power. I'm going to have to find something bigger and badder than that. Or I'm a dead man, because it's trying to kill me. I mean, I don't know about you, but the phrase of my life. Anybody ever heard someone tell you you're your own worst enemy? They don't tell that to normal people. They also don't tell them you have a lot of potential. Those people are getting things done. They don't have potential. I'm the potential guy. Let's go to page 44, we agnostics, and we're going to wrap up step one more time. He's still going to hammer us a little bit more with it here in the first paragraph. Who wants to read the first paragraph? Anybody?
All right.
Thank you.
In the preceding chapters, you have learned subject alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take in, you're probably an alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness to open spiritual experience.
Boom. So there it is. I know that if you go to the literature table at most meetings, you're going to see something from World Service. It's called the 20 questions. They're nicely written. I mean, it's the only test I ever scored high on. But the truth is, you know, Wilson only gives us two questions. He just gave them to you. He said, question number one, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. I'm not going to do it, 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 and wind up doing it anyway. Who's done that? Or question number two, if when drinking I have a little control of the amount I take, I'm only going to stop by and have two and then go home and mow the yard. Whole paycheck later. Who's done that? Over the limit. So if I have those two things, or if I have one of them in trouble, but if I have those two things, I'm probably alcoholic and I'm suffering from an illness which probably only a spiritual experience will conquer. Boom. That's it. I heard a guy give a talk a while back, and I just was amazed. I loved it. He talked about that, the idea of why this is a spiritual program. Why do I need a power? And he was discussing this, and he was talking about Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was the guy that 12-step Ebbie Thatcher, who then 12-step Bill Wilson from the Oxford groups. And Roland Hazard had went to Zurich, Switzerland, to stay with Carl Jung, who was a prominent psychologist in his day. And he went there and he lived there for almost a year. He got therapy and, you know, started understanding himself, and he's not going to drink anymore. Roland Hazard had so much money. I mean, they were wealthy, wealthy people. And he goes there and he leaves the clinic with a lot of confidence. I think he made it to Paris before he was drunk. And then he comes back to him and he asks him, you know, you got to help me. What's up? And thank God, Jung wasn't running some, you know, $50,000 a month rehab in Malibu or something, you know, and took him back in. And thank God he wasn't trying to make more money off the guy. Thank God he told him the truth. He looked him in the eye and said, I can't help you. I can't help you. If I were you, every once in a while, alcoholics have these spiritual occurrences, some sort of thing that happens to them and they stop drinking. If I were you, I'd try to find some of those cats because I can't help you. Thank God he told him that. Thank God Roland spent the time and all that therapy and all that to get to the point where he went, wait a second. And he knew the truth. Like, he looked at this guy in the eye and this man cannot help him. He's done. And so he comes back to the U.S. and he finds the Oxford groups and he gets hungry. Really, really hungry, because that was the answer. I have to find a way of living, and it's got to be bigger. This process, I think, is designed to awaken the spirit. It's not to come here and not drink and just, how you doing today? I'm hanging on, man. It ain't about that. I'm getting through it, you know. It's not about that. It's about finding a way. It's a quest for power. It's a quest for power. I heard a story a long time ago that I loved, and it was about these scientists were doing these experiments with lab rats. And what they did was they found that these lab rats had like a mammal, so they have a spot in the brain called the pleasure center. And when you stimulate the pleasure center, it floods the brain with a substance called dopamine, which gets you loaded. That's why I get drunk. Dopamine floods the brain. I'm high. Love it. Who wouldn't? What they did was they put these tiny electrodes on top of the rat's brain. They give them a little charge of electricity, and it would affect the pleasure center, and the rat would get high. The rat would feel stoned. So they put a little pedal in there, and the rat would hit the pedal, and every time he hit the pedal, he'd get a charge. So what he would do, I think they're like us, he just would lay on the pedal. You know, and they would parade female rats in there, and they'd be like, no, dude, I'm partying, you know, and they'd just... And so this is the scary part. The scary part is what they did was they unplugged the battery to the power. So the rat would hit the pedal and hit the pedal and hit the pedal and nothing would happen. And then rather than go back to being a rat, it would just crawl up in the corner of the cage and die from dehydration. Because without the juice, what's the point? What's the point? And what we're talking about here in this process, if I do what's asked of me to do, we're talking about turning back on the power. We're talking about turning it back on so I can find what it is that I'm looking for in the bag and the bottle, living a way of life that is spiritual in nature. If you don't like the word spiritual, that's moral. If you don't like that, that's just loving other people. And I think the steps are designed to teach me. I got to take the steps to recover. And I think they're designed really to make me a better tool. To make me a better tool so I can be more effective at helping. That's what I've been taught. It's been ingrained in my head from day one, because I'm so into me and me. And there's nothing that gets me off me. It's bad when I'm like, it's ugly. I'm like a tweaker working on his acne. It ain't pretty, you know. I mean, I know we don't have any tweakers in here. You know, I know there's none of those guys. They don't live in Visalia. I mean, they don't have any tweaking Visalia. So, yeah. Yeah, those aren't chimneys. Those aren't chimneys. There's meth labs. So on page 45, he says, lack of power is our dilemma. I had a friend of mine from Tennessee said, boy, our lack of dilemma is my power. I thought, that's pretty damn good. Lack of dilemma is my power. And it says here, we had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find that power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. This book is designed to introduce me to that. And we can go through, we agnostics, I can look at all this stuff. All I need to do in step two, really, I can study this thing backward and forward, but this is what it boils down to for me. On page 46, it says, we found, on the middle of the paragraph, yes, we have agnostic temperament. You guys on that page? 46? Could somebody read, we found that as soon? Everybody there? 46? Are we on page 46? Would somebody read that second line down, we found that as soon?
We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God.
Boom. I just have to want to want. I think step two is the go-to-meeting step. Because if I'm going to a meeting, why am I going to a meeting? Am I going there because I like the coffee? Am I going there because the girls are pretty? Usually I'm going there, well, that's some of us might. But I'm usually going there because I think something's going to happen if I go there. Even when I'm sick with alcoholism, before I ever got sober, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought there was something there. I didn't know what it was, but there was. I tell you what I used to do. I had this telemarketing job, and I used to get off work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would come home and drink. I'd start drinking, and at 3 o'clock, there was a 3 o'clock meeting on a Wednesday night where my sponsor, I found later on, was going to. I used to drink until 2:30, jump in the shower, brush my teeth, drive to the meeting, and sit in the meeting and listen to them share. And then get in the car and drive back home and continue drinking. And the question for years was, why would you do that? Why would you stop in the middle of a run and attend a meeting of AA and then go home and drink? And for years, I didn't know why I did that. And one day it came to me. And here's the answer. It was the only hope I had. It was the only hope I had. That was it. You know why? What do you always see in every ghetto in the country? What are two things that are prevalent in every ghetto, every slum? Liquor store? What else? So there, of course. Liquor store, what else? Every ghetto, every slum. Liquor store, what else? What are we in right here?
Church.
Liquor stores and churches. Why? Why? They both provide man hope. They both provide man hope. And this is what this is about. This step is about the hope. This is, regardless of what I believe in, whether I believe in any power at all, if I believe for a second that, here's how I break down step two. Is it remotely possible that doing this stuff with you guys might help me with my problem? And if the answer is yes, boom, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're on your way. I can let this get, my friend Scott used to say this. He used to say, if you don't believe in God, that's okay. If you don't believe in a power, that's okay. Take the steps. You will be contacted. I tell you a quick story because it's hard. The God thing's tough for some people. I had this girl in my home group. This is her story, and I love it. I watched it. Her name was Diane, and Diane was a young girl that was born with a cleft palate. She couldn't talk for the first 8 years of her life. She was abused, locked in a closet. Things were done to her that shouldn't happen to little girls up till the time she was 12. She had a very, very rough life, and she grew up, and she's a drunk. And she's grown up, she works for the studios, and she comes home every night and just drinks herself to death. And she's dying of alcoholism and comes to AA, and you're talking about your God, you're talking. And she looks you in the eye and says, where was your God at when they were doing that to me? Where was he at then? And what are you going to say to that? I'm not going to try to talk her off. So anyway, her sponsor told her, honey, you have to find a God. You've got to find a power of some sort, honey. So she says, well, I guess my power would be my dog Soda. She had a German Shepherd that she named after the soda on Seinfeld, so she named the dog Soda. And so her sponsor said, "Well, okay, that's fine, whatever." So she would get up in the morning and say her prayers to Soda, and you know, help Soda help stay and keep me sober. And she would do this for a while, and that's what she did. And this went on for a short while, maybe a couple of years. And she started taking the steps and doing inventory and all that. And one day she came to the meeting and she was in tears and she was crying. And Soda was very sick. And then she shared how she was praying to God to help Soda. And it had happened. It had happened. It's switched. However it happens, it happens. I know people that you got to find this, you got to find that. I'm not one of those guys. I'm like, you got to get what you got to get. If you believe this process will work and you will take the actions, at some point in the game, this is going to come more and more real for you. It has for me, because it has changed over the years. It has just been this, it's went back and forth with my beliefs and how I understand. I've had some stuff happen here with this. So, however you have to do it. There's a lot of great information in here. I just want to go really to, we read the bedevilments earlier, which I think on 52 are a good barometer for if I'm back into alcoholism, even dry drunk. But I think on page 55, where he brings up this piece here, because when he told us earlier, this book, that's what this book is about, is to help me to find a power greater than myself. On 55, he kind of gives me the roadmap. And on 55, would somebody read, "Actually, we're fooling ourselves"? Would somebody read that? One of you ladies want to read? No? Yeah, please. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Anybody want to comment on that? Anybody? Thank you very much. Yes.
Jumping back to page 47, you know, work with guys, and this really helped me when I was explaining to you. This is kind of a scary step, and it's a real wordy chapter, really wordy in there, but it comes down to this, and this, you know, I'm going through this with guys, I read this, or ask them this question, you kind of see some relief, and, you know, this is the instruction for the second step. We need to ask ourselves mm-hmm. one short question.
Mm-hmm.
Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, he emphatically assures him that he is on his way. You know, that's, you can see that. That way as well.
explain that to me. I was like, oh, you know, I thought I had to understand all this. And, you know, but the guy said, you know my story. If you believe that, he said, yeah. I'm like, okay, it's good enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Keep me killed, so.
Thank you, dear.
Not that difficult.
Thank you. The chapter, we agnostics really means we don't know. We don't know. Agnosia is knowledge. Is no knowledge without knowledge. So we don't know. And my old sponsor used to say something I love. He'd say, you know a great definition of an agnostic? I said, no, what's that? He'd say, it's a guy who gets on his knees in the morning, turns his will and his life over to the care of a God, sits quietly with that God, prays and means it, then gets in the car and acts like there is no God. Which is the truth. And here, after we get through this, it tells me this wonderful promise. I'm fooling myself. That deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. Though it may be obscured or later on, he says, blocked off. Blocked off. You know, a little while ago, it wasn't sunny out there, but I assure you, the sun was shining. The clouds had obscured the sun. And I'm blocked off by calamity, by drama, by the things I'm afraid of, by everything going on in my life that's bothering me. I'm blocked off by that. I'm blocked off by my own ego, the pomp, the pride. I'm blocked off by that. Or by the worship of other things. The worship of other things. What do I lend my attention to the most? If you pie chart my day, make a circle, and you go, well, I had an hour at AA, worked this many hours, and I thought of her or the rest. We know where my heart's at. We know what I'm worshiping. It's clear. The worship of other things, the things I put between me and my relationship with this power that I put there, they're in the way. It says that's what's blocking me. We finally saw that some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just the feeling we have for a friend. I sponsored this guy one time, and he was new in treatment, and he was a devout Satanist, and he had a higher power. And I said, well, I don't know your higher power, but I don't know if he's got, you know, your best interest at heart. Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, we sit there talking, and he said, well, I'm trying to think of a higher power. And he said, how about my daughter? And I said, well, how about the love of your daughter? And he rolled with that. Because no matter what I think, I can always... When I get a guy who's really having a difficult time with this, I will ask him, is there anybody in your life that you love? And I go, well, of course I do. I go, well, who is it? My mom. I love my mom. Really? How much do you love your mom? She's everything to me. You know, they start describing it. I say, well, prove it to me. Well, I bought her this. Well, I did that for her. It's not proving you love her. You're telling me things you do and all that. But the connection that you have with your mother that is here to here, that thing that is that connective tissue, whatever it is that we know is real, that cannot be quantified, that cannot be measured, that's not linear. We know it's there, don't we? And they'll go, yeah. And I go, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that. That is what we're talking about. That is the thing that we're trying to describe. And I'm trying to get in touch with a bigger, powerful thing here that will leave me of my problems and provide me and leave me in a spot where I'm happy, joyous, and free, and hopefully a life that's useful and whole, which is what the promise is here. And it says here, sometimes we had to search fearlessly. Where do we do that? Made us say the searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. He's setting up the groundwork for what has to happen. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality where? Not in the new speedboat. Not in the new four-wheel drive. Not in the new house. Not in the new model girlfriend or boyfriend. Not in the bank account. We didn't find anywhere there. We found it deep down. Deep down within us. Deep down within us. If we can sweep away the prejudice and enables me to think honestly, encourages me to search diligently in myself. If you wish, you can join us in the broad highway. And here comes another promise. With this attitude, you cannot fail. With this attitude, I cannot fail. What a powerful thing to say to a guy like me. And then on page 57, he throws this last line, the last sentence. says, 57, when we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. You guys all there? Take your finger and put it on that page. And then let's go over to page 84 and grab the book like this. This book is really thick. It looks really daunting. It looks like a lot of work. Too much for a guy like me that's lazy. But this is what I have to do to get there, to start. Look at that. Isn't that incredible? When you look at that, there's not very much there. This is to draw near to him, and how he will disclose himself is for me to just do that. Now, I got to do more after that, but this is the start. This is the start. When a guy showed me that, I went, oh. I made this big, big thing out of it. It was going to take forever, and I found every reason in the world to sidestep it, not do it, and move on. I want to go to page 60 of the book, our description. And they're going to do it one more time. He's going to do it one more time. Who wants to read that, our description?
Our description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures were born after made clear three pertinent ideas. A, that your alcoholic could not manage our own life. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he would stop. Being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that is just what we do.
Boom. Am I convinced of A, B, and C? Do I believe in A, B, and C? Do I agree to A, B, and C? And if a guy tells me, well, I don't know, then I'll say, well, what do we have to go back to? There's no point in going on. If he cannot concede to that, let's watch a movie. Because what's the point? I've got to, it's in order for a solution. A solution has no bearing unless there's a problem. So I gotta find the problem. And so at this point in the game, if you ever read the original manuscript? Oh, it's beautiful. I love it. The wording, it's a little tougher. The stuff that went to the typeset before they edited it was right in this part right here. He said, if these three ideas have been designed to sell you. And if you're not convinced, either reread the book at this point or else throw it away. It said that in the book. Like, whoa. He was a little hard-headed. But am I at this place? If I'm at this place, I'm at the deciding point. What's the decision? What is the decision? Decision. It's a decision. It's the word comes from a Latin word. The word is called scissory. Scissory means to cut. Scissors cut. If you make an incision, you cut into something. If you circumcise, you cut around something. To make a decision, I cut away. And if I'm here, I've cut away any other option for me to roll. I'm either in or I'm out. And if I make a decision, it's followed by action. I'm a guy that makes lots of resolutions and intentions, which are always followed by still more resolutions and intentions. And so you might recall, a decision means I'm going to take some action. There's no other way for me to go. The jig is up. I got to do something here. And the reason why I have to is because I'm suffering from selfishness and self-centeredness, which we're going to talk about. I want to read something real quickly from a different piece of literature, and then we're going to take a break. This is not AA approved. I'm a conference approved guy. Usually it's not conference approved, but this is not an AA meeting. It's a workshop, clearly, because if anybody can share here, this is not AA. This is a workshop. Everybody in here, members of AA, are reading AA literature, but this is not an AA meeting. It can't be, because we're allowing other people to share and all of that. So that being said, I can show some non-AA literature. It's called New Pair of Glasses. It was written by a guy at a Laguna Beach named Chuck C. But in the beginning of this book, there's something that he says that I really, really enjoyed, back to steps one and two. In the beginning here, the prefaces, this guy writes a little thing. And to me, this is probably one of the best descriptions of alcoholism I've ever read. Check this out. He says, "What sets AA head and shoulders above other attempts to reverse the disease of alcoholism, however, is in its immensely successful efforts to literally alter the relationship of the alcoholic to his or her world. In effect, to provide a different perception of the same environment. the most baffling characteristic of alcoholism, both to the alcoholic and to those who must deal with him, is the paradox in which the conflicts of sober reality eventually always become untenable. I can't live in it. Leading to the return to alcohol or drugs for relief. Scientists who study alcoholics have stated the patient may get to a point in his sobriety where he actually must drink to preserve his own sanity. That's not good. Then the relief chemical begins to present an obvious problem. The outside pressures begin to mount regarding its use, and the pain and discomfort in the patient begin to increase. Neither sobriety nor the chemical counterpart can provide a meaningful cessation of this conflict. This almost hopeless condition of mind and body is known as alcoholism, a truly strange disease in which withdrawal from alcohol has little if any salutary effect, and often makes the emotional agony intensify. The so-called, quote, miracle of AA is in its ability, if its principles are rigorously applied, is to gradually alter the perceptions of reality within these distraught personalities. The goal often achieved is to eventually experience a life with a degree of comfort never before for people sharing this affliction of mind and body. And since the symptoms of a sober alcoholic seem to be almost identical to those of an acute or intense neurotic, these same principles can be applicable to a great many additional lives. But as it is stated again and again in this book, the principles must be used, not just evaluated, analyzed, or passively accepted. We're going to talk about the real problem in the next couple pages.
So before we take a break, I think I can pass the basket. So we'll go ahead and pass the basket now. And the feet can.
Are we done, Doc?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, good.